Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
My only safe ground was this demon story, and if I got off this, then I would be exposed. I tried to pull back and steer it, you know. When the other three doctors, they encouraged me, to continue with this demon thing. And then this is how it caught on so much, and went to unbelievable heights.
A Molasses Manifesto production, brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 18, The Demons and the Doctors. Act 1, The Doctors Made Me Do It.
Alright, there is something I wanted to tell you that just came to mind. The only way, right, like, that this demon story and things went as far as it did was because of the feedback I got from the doctors, you understand? My telling them this whole aspect of Sam Carr and his talking dog and other things like this, right? I was trying to convince myself, mostly, you know? I just, speaking it aloud, I was attempting to somehow say, show them, well, now you see, what do you think of this? Am I possessed or what? And their feedback inspired me to go further. You understand what I'm saying?
After David Berkowitz was arrested and the story of the demons started to spill out all over the table, he was taken almost immediately to Kings County Mental Hospital, where he was examined by psychiatrists in order to determine just what exactly was going on with him. It was there, over approximately the next 2 months, that he told the following story. Starting with the death of his adoptive mother Pearl in 1967 when he was just 14 years old. Quote, "It was part of a master plan to break me down. It was no accident that she got cancer. My dad doesn't know about it. But it wasn't a natural thing. They had plans for me, like, you know, kill. Somebody put something in her food, evil forces, poison. She went out to eat one day and she never came back," end quote. According to David, demons had been responsible for absolutely every unfortunate thing that had ever happened to him, including, but not limited to, the death of his adoptive mother Pearl, as well as his inability to make friends. Quote, "There is a force to turn other people away from me. Somebody wants me destroyed, makes people dislike me, and girls be not attracted to me in any way. If I had close friends or girlfriends, I would be able to resist the force. I would be able to resist if I had people," end quote. If he only had friends, none of this would have happened. Quote, "I had no defenses. It was my own fault for not seeking out friends. Without friends, I had no defenses against demonic attack. I don't know why I was alone all the time," end quote. According to David, it was demons who had kept him isolated from others, and it was demons that had directed him on who and when to kill. Not his own anger, not his own jealousy, and not his own hand. Quote, "The demons needed blood. The feeling of killing innocent people. The feeling of killing and defying God. It was war. They need that blood. Me? I never needed or wanted blood. but after I shot someone, the demons would move in and feast, end quote. As he saw it, David was the good guy in all this, the victim. Quote, I tried to do what they said, but they were never satisfied. Sometimes I argued with them, asking why they were making me do these things, but they never answered. They just laughed at me. I wasn't a bad person, but they were making me do bad things. I didn't want to. I did everything they said to do, and still they weren't satisfied. End quote. An army of demons told him what to do and when to do it, and they did it through barking dogs. Quote, they looked like dogs, but they had many human qualities. They could talk. They acted human, but they weren't. They weren't human or dogs either. They were demons. They began to howl things, yell like maniacs. They threw tantrums, strange things. It was vicious. Saliva used to drip down their mouths. They wanted to get at children, to tear them up. Young children, end quote. So the army of demons David was privy to inhabited neighborhood dogs in order to communicate with him, but they were also known by David to take on human form as well, resulting in an elaborate hierarchy of demonic henchmen, which coincidentally were comprised almost entirely of David's neighbors and landlords, both past and present. And perched at the top of this all-important hierarchy was none other than General Jack Cosmo himself, a character whom Berkowitz had based on his previous landlord in New Rochelle, Jack Cassara. Jack had two German Shepherds, which drove Berkowitz crazy and no doubt earned him the position, but he was also the same individual to whom Berkowitz had mailed the, quote, get well soon card that tied the Cars and the Cassaras together, ultimately aiding in his eventual arrest. It was General Jack Cosmo, according to Berkowitz, who had originally ordered him to kill, through his dogs, of course. Quote, they called up to me from the yard. They came into my head. They told me what they were, demons. Who Jack was, General Jack Cosmo, general of this region of demons. He wanted people to die. That's it. Pretty simple. End quote. Directly under General Jack Cosmo was Father Sam, a 6,000-year-old demon based on Berkowitz's neighbor Sam Carr, who he absolutely loathed, earning him the title he infamously mentioned in one of the letters. Father Sam was, according to Berkowitz, quote, a high official of the Devil's Legion, end quote. Next came Joaquin the Joker, based on Jack Netto, another of Berkowitz's neighbors who had, according to Berkowitz, recently been demoted by General Cosmo for, quote, not following orders, end quote. There was also John Wheaties, who some believed to be Sam Carr's son, John Wheat Carr, whose nickname was Wheaties. At any rate, Berkowitz said his house was a, quote, holiday inn for demons who stopped there to sleep while they were traveling the earth. Which tracks, because Berkowitz, upon his arrest, told police that there were many demons living in Sam Carr's attic. So police, in turn, stormed in, guns drawn, to check it out. And last but not least, there was, of course, Berkowitz's downstairs neighbor, Craig Glassman, whom he also despised, due to the preferred volume of his television set, and for whom he did not devise a title. Craig was just Craig. Quote, as long as Craig Glassman is in the world, there will never be any peace. But there will be plenty of murders. Craig Glassman worships the devil and has power over me, end quote. Although all of the characters that Berkowitz devised seem to have varying degrees of authority between them, all of them seem to have a power over Berkowitz that he himself was unable to escape. In the end, what Berkowitz had laid out to police and psychiatrists alike was essentially an intricate military-like organization of neighbors, landlords, and their dogs who were scattered around the Northeast, dead set on wrecking havoc. And so it is in this way that the whole thing was a rather polite intersection of what Berkowitz had experienced during his time in the military, both in terms of the dogmatic structure of the army itself, as well as the Baptist doctrine of hellfire and brimstone that he had encountered while stationed at Fort Knox. It was, according to Berkowitz, quote, a conspiracy of evil. Sam, who was Satan, and Joaquin the Joker, and that wretched building on Wicker Street in Yonkers, which was a Holiday Inn for demons who traveled the world, end quote. But one thing remained true. No matter where the demons were going or what they were doing, they always seemed to have big plans for Berkowitz, as he had somehow become their absolute go-to when it came to carrying out their evil plans. After a murder, Berkowitz said, quote, Sam was pleased. Before a murder, quote, I had my orders, end quote. Lifting again from the Christian doctrine, this time specifically from the singular arrangement of the Holy Trinity into a unified deity, which consists of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit in three parts, David Berkowitz explained his relationship to Sam this way. Quote, I am the son of Sam. It wasn't me. It was Sam that was working through me. I mean, me and the son of Sam, there's just one body, but we weren't the same people. Sam used me as his tool, end quote. And so in this way, it was the very unholy trinity of Sam, Berkowitz, and Harvey the dog. Quote, Sam would tell me through his dog as he usually did, when the night was right. But the dog's not really a dog, it just looks like a dog. Sam just gave me an idea where to go. When I got the word, I didn't know who I would go out to kill, but I would know when I saw the right people. Without Sam, I am nothing. End quote. Then he seems to admit that maybe he did enjoy killing after all, saying, quote, You just felt very good after you did it. It just happens to be satisfying, to get the source of the blood. I felt that Sam was relieved I came through, end quote. And after all, he couldn't stop. How could he? He was an enlisted member of Sam's satanic army, and by virtue of this enrollment, was at the unending behest of Sam's demonic henchmen. Quote, The demons were turning me into a soldier. A soldier can't stop every time he shoots someone and weep. He simply shoots the enemy. They were people I had to kill. I can't stop and weep over them. You have to be strong. You have to survive. End quote. So Berkowitz, according to him, was just trying to hold it all together and do a good job, but at the same time, he never forgot to afford himself quite a decent amount of removal from the whole situation. And always remembered to lay the blame squarely at the demon's feet. Quote, They always selected the people I'd shoot. It wasn't up to me. I never made choices. They always did. They wanted me to kill. End quote. David then goes on to give the world a bit of advice. Quote, The people should try to destroy Sam, if they can. It would be hard because Sam and the demons have been around for so long, and they'll continue till the end, until God comes and destroys them in the last heroic final battle. End quote. Even in psychiatric care for the murder of 6 and the injury of 10, David Berkowitz's heroic fantasies were never too far away. I mean, after all, as far as he saw it, it was him alone who could help bring down Sam. He had a lot of insider information on the whole situation, after all. And all of this satanic yarn spinning, as it turned out, could not have come about at a better time, as it did, by chance, occur just as Cold War hysteria in the United States had begun to fuel satanic hysteria, which would ultimately grip the nation and define an era known as, quote, the Satanic Panic, loosely stretching from the late 70s to the very end of the 1980s. He basically said it himself. Quote, People really don't know anything. They don't know what's happening in the world. Take the United States. Some people think it's the president that has his hand moving everything. Others think it's the rich people like the Rockefellers or the Kennedys, but it's neither of them, you know. It's forces, God and Satan. They have their hands in the world. One day God is going to bring peace to the world, and there's going to be hope for mankind. I guess it was Satan's will for me to kill innocent people. It happens. Why? I don't know why. It just happened, but God will want to help people, and in the end, peace will win. People are dying every day in the most horrible ways. There's nothing we can do about it. End quote. So given all these factors, maybe it's not too much of a surprise that the reaction of the doctors was, according to David, rapt interest. Or maybe it's just as simple as the fact that the story included a talking dog. I mean, who can resist a talking dog? As far as motivation to spin such a tale goes, David had plenty. Beyond the attention and the relative distance from the crimes the story afforded him, It was ultimately the reaction of the doctors to the story that would determine whether or not David would be deemed competent to stand trial before a jury of his peers. And at the moment, it was looking like, no, definitely not.
Once you're charged with a crime, you either hire or the court will assign you an attorney, and those attorneys will use whatever they feel is legitimate to mount a defense, and it is their obligation under our legal system, even if they know a person is guilty, to do all they can to excuse or mitigate the crime. And in David Berkowitz's case, he would have seemed to have had an ironclad insanity defense by virtue of his story of communicating with demons and talking dogs and a childhood history of rage and violence and anger and the apparent inability to distinguish supernatural fantasies from reality. And there were psychiatrists who were hired at that time to interview him, and they bought right into his stories of demon possession.
Because the psychiatrists brought in to assess David believed what he was telling them, or rather believed that David believed what he was telling them, David reasoned quite conveniently that it was all their fault all this was happening, just as he had done with the demons.
If they had said it after they heard me talking for about 3 or 4 hours on these demons and things and the crimes, right? Or the part they allegedly played in the crimes, you know. Then if they would have said, oh, now, come on, David. Let's be sensible. This isn't true, and you know it. This is just trying to find justification for your crimes. Now, you know it. If they would have been stern, right? Not as lenient, you know. Not as gullible. You know, for professional men, you wouldn't think they'd be as gullible, especially the Dr. Schwartz, who's one of the top psychiatrists of Brooklyn. Yet he was the most naive and gullible of the bunch. And he's the director of one of the biggest psychiatric units in that borough. If he would have been stern and just says, now come on, you gotta realize your own guilt, he didn't do that, you know. His feedback, the demons. You know, tell me about this. He had his pen there, and he was totally enthralled with what I was saying, you know? Like, you know, like, my God, oh, you know? And this feedback was like encouragement, you know, more. Till I was making up names, like, that I never even, like, I just made at the spur of the moment.
Look at me, I'm smarter than the smartest and most famous psychiatrist in all of Brooklyn. He's no worthy opponent. I can outwit him easily. And so, David sees it, as he sees most things, as him pulling one over on them. And moreover, due to this, as he saw it, it was the doctors who were holding up his healing process, not him.
Oh my God, oh, you're such a sick man. You know, and I went on and on, you know, eliciting sympathy from him. You understand what I'm saying? When I really deserve punishment. He was being, you know, treating me as sick, you know. He was being sympathetic, and the other doctors were being sympathetic, and the staff was being sympathetic. Oh, Mr. Berkowitz, you know, you've been through so much. And this prevented my real conscience, my real guilt feelings from coming through. You know, I had to suppress them. Even though I knew I was guilty, you understand? I didn't have the courage to tell him, this isn't true. So I suppressed it. In the meantime, I got all his attention, sympathy, you know, and, you know, oh, poor guy. And I deserved a right punishment.
And while the demonic henchman story, as he says, did come with a shitload of attention, which he did enjoy, it also came with the label of insanity, which he did not enjoy. That label undermined his, quote, accomplishments, his, quote, achievements, his intellect, his legitimacy as a smart, cunning criminal who had outwitted police in the largest manhunt New York City had ever seen for a period of approximately 13 months. which was no small achievement as he saw it. It also undermined his very being, and beyond that, it stood between him and what he saw as his just reward, his ultimate punishment.
And immediately I was labeled paranoid, you know, because my delusions, which they really weren't delusions, you see, but they, thinking it's such, set them, lined them up with the mental illness. They worked on, broke down all these different personalities of the demons that I made up or something, and it just went on and on. But I saw the attention that I was getting from them, Like they were, and it said I was filling notebook after notebook of all this stuff. I can't even remember this stuff anymore. They didn't look into my childhood or anything. They just passed over all that. And if they would have looked into all this, the adoption of things and my inability to relate to other people and have a social life and all that, during that time period of my life, and then they would have understood it, but they didn't,
According to David, his childhood was discussed not at all. And so the factors that had played out in David's mind so heavily in the years since first learning of his adoption in 1958 and his first violent attack on Christmas Eve of 1975, the adoption, the death fantasy, God, his angels, his shame complex, the deaths of both his birth mother and his adoptive mother that he personally felt responsible for, all remained hidden. And with all that hidden, all that lay spread out over the table in every conceivable direction was an elaborate web of supernatural forces dead set on turning David into a murderous machine.
The initial defense psychiatrists who were called in, supposedly at least one of them, an independent psychiatrist, Dr. Schwartz, was spellbound by his tale of demon possession, and he believed he was being manipulated by demons.
And according to David, it wasn't the first time Dr. Schwartz had been taken in by stories such as this one. Dr. Schwartz had also testified in the incredibly infamous case known as Amityville Horror that had taken place a few years before.
So the feedback of the doctors was important. Oh, let me tell you this. Now I remember about Dr. Schwartz. He's supposed to be one of the top regarded professionals, right? Do you remember the Amityville Horror case?
Mm-hmm.
That guy, Ronald DeFeo, who's a Clinton State person, he did the same thing I did. After he was arrested, he began to say about all these, the demons and things. You've heard how the Amityville Horror thing was finally admitted to be a hoax, right? Mm-hmm. The Lutzes, the family who lived in the house that ran off, they admitted that they made it up after drinking wine or something, It was in all the papers that it was a hoax, that they were just drinking wine and eating some cheese or something, and they invented the whole thing. Less than a year ago, admitted this. You remember this, right? Well, DeFeo, his line of defense was there were other beings that possessed the house, which caused the Lutz family, who have to move in afterwards, to, maybe they were just very suggestible, but to sort to put all this together, Well, anyhow, when he was going to trial, right, they had his competency hearing. The doctor that was called in to examine him was Dr. Daniel Schwartz, who happened to be my doctor later on, not my doctor, but one of the psychiatrists. Dr. Schwartz said that DeFeo was insane, paranoid. He said that this guy DeFeo suffers from a mental disease because he's got these delusions that supernatural beings and demons caused him to shoot the six members of his family. The other doctors disagreed, and of course DeFeo went to Clinton and almost apple pie, So here's the insane man hallucinating and hearing voices, you see. But this shows you where he's at, because he screwed up on that case and he was embarrassed by it.
So there was potentially some worry that Dr. Schwartz would go that way on this case too, finding Berkowitz mentally incompetent to stand trial. Because if David was indeed found to be incompetent to stand trial, it was possible that he could be out on the streets in as little as a year, as it would then be up to the doctors, not the penal system, as to when he would be released. So people were worried, outraged at the possibility. And all it hinged on were the opinions of psychiatrists Schwartz and Weidenbacher, as their recommendation ultimately informed the outcome of the upcoming competency trial. Act 2, the competency trial.
See, they examined me first. They were appointed by the court. We know Wiedenbacher and Schwartz were the two doctors from Kings County Psychiatric Hospital and Prison Hospital. They were appointed by the court to be completely impartial and to examine me to make a determination. First, if I was competent to stand trial. And second, if I was, later on, their findings would be whether I was insane at the time of the crime. So they had two parts.
The specific questions handed down from the court were as follows. Can the defendant recall details of the crimes? Did he know who and where he was at the time of the crimes? Did he understand the charges against him? Did he understand the difference between right and wrong? Could he stand the stress of a trial? In order to answer these questions, Schwartz and Wiedenbacher were to prepare a document that addressed these parameters and present it back to the court. Based on this report, the judge would make a decision regarding David's competency to stand trial. So there was a lot riding on it, for everyone. The document Schwartz and Wiedenbacher were preparing would decide it, more or less.
They spent about a month and a half examining me, right? Questioning me. A month and a half, not every day. It only came out to about 12 hours of examinations. And they had to prepare a written report which was sealed by the judge. It was given immediately over to the judge to be sealed, to be read at the court hearing. Yeah, you understand? They talked about a 6-page report, triple space, you know, about all. It was all about the demons and things. And the cover head was a standard form that said, this man has been found competent or incompetent, and you can cross out one to stand trial on the charges of, and you list the charges, and that's it. It's like a one paragraph thing that's read to the court. The rest is sealed, right?
12 hours of examination. That's 7 hours less than the interview you've been listening to on this podcast, which my co-host Jack Jones recorded for his series of newspaper articles, which he wrote on Berkowitz for the Rochester Democrat Chronicle. That seems significant to me. Anyway, on the day of the competency trial, everyone filed into the courtroom and Dr. Schwartz handed his and Dr. Wiedenbacher's findings to the judge.
So the judge opened it up. The courtroom was packed. This was about 2 months after I was first arrested. Just a competency hearing to see if I'd be allowed to stand trial. The open report, Dr. Schwartz, Dr. Wiedenbacher working together to find this individual, David Berkowitz, to be incompetent to stand trial.
Dr. Schwartz and his associate found reason to support the demon theory on the grounds that it was indicative of mental illness in Berkowitz, which rendered him potentially, at trial, not guilty by reason of insanity.
This was everyone's deepest and darkest fears coming true. The families of the victims present to hear that the man who had murdered their children wouldn't even have a trial. The courtroom went crazy.
Well, everybody stirred up, you know, in the courtroom, man. Because the victims were there in full force. And I was just let out, and then the district attorney was mad as hell.
As Berkowitz states, the DA was mad as hell, and the judge wasn't too into it either.
The prosecutor and the judge who was hearing the arguments pre-trial either knew or was wise enough to suspect that this was being concocted by the defendant, in this case, David Berkowitz, in order to escape punishment for his crimes. The prosecution would have none of that and realized that if they just rolled over for an insanity defense, the public would have been outraged. And they called in their own expert forensic psychiatrist interviewer who conducted a series of interviews with Berkowitz.
He says, well, I'm going to get a doctor to examine Berkowitz. I'll find an impartial doctor. He found Dr. Abrahamson, top man in the field. Abrahamson came in and spent about 20, 25 hours examining me.
Interstage left, a small, elderly psychiatrist from Norway named Dr. Abrahamson.
Dr. Abrahamson was a fairly noted international forensic psychiatrist, Norwegian, who immigrated to the U.S. and began working in the criminal system in New York City area, wrote at least one book before his book on David Berkowitz, and that was an analysis of the minds and motivations of people who murder in an exploration and effort to identify telltale signs and indicators of potential future murderers. His job was to determine whether the Son of Sam, aka David Berkowitz, was mentally capable of standing trial and participating in a meaningful way in his own defense against charges of serial murder.
And so the whole process would start over, this time with Dr. Abrahamson. But it wasn't going to start right away. As with everything in the bureaucratic systems of government, the process would be slow. And in the end, it took several months before Berkowitz and Abrahamson found themselves sitting across the table from each other. Act 3. Dr. Abrahamson, I presume?
I think it was Mark Twain who said, if you want to be a successful liar, you have to have a good memory.
You gotta understand that, like, the first 2 months I was talking about all these demons and demons and demons with these doctors, right? And then for about 3 or 4 months, they didn't hardly talk to me at all. You know, I was just being housed there, awaiting trial. I was not getting any therapy, or they were not really talking to me, you understand? And in about 3 or 4 months, I had forgotten nearly everything I had told them.
Whoops. I mean, it was, after all, pretty complicated. And I can't help but think of the line Jeff Bridges utters as the dude in the Coen brothers' classic film The Big Lebowski when he described the case his character is involved in. Quote, "This is a very complicated case, a lot of ins and a lot of outs, a lot of what have yous, and a lot of strands to keep in my head, man. A lot of strands to keep in old Duder's head," end quote. A lot of strands to keep in David's head. Strands that, in the end, he could not keep straight.
Unless he had written it down and could have read it back verbatim. And usually a story like that gets bigger and more fantastic the more times you tell it, and embellished with added details, which, after a few months, most people are going to forget.
As Dr. Abrahamson sat across from David, listening silently and chewing on the end of his pencil, it was obvious to him from the get that this story involving the demons and the talking dog, etc., was complete bullshit. So much so that David began to realize it too, although not for a while. David at this point was still worked up into quite a frenzy over everything that had happened. All the excitement, all the encouragement, all the narcissism, all the unresolved feelings from his childhood, from his life, all the feelings from his underdeveloped conscience over what he had done. All of it added up to what had been quite a convincing round of storytelling. But as it was starting to slip away, David was still very much caught up in all of those dynamics. Not to mention the fact that David's lawyers wanted him to be declared incompetent, which meant that they had made it quite clear to him that Abrahamson was the enemy. Still, Abrahamson could recognize a load when he smelled one.
Dr. Abrahamson realized that from the very beginning. And I began to realize that even though I wasn't in favor of working with the guy then, I didn't like him only because I was fearful of him. Because he was about to overexpose my game, you know what I mean? And I was fearful of him. And my defense attorneys had convinced me that the man was absolutely evil, was paid off by the district attorney.
David was, as it turns out, a low-level fan of Abrahamson's and knew who he was even before they had met, as David, in his research of murder and murderers, had read one of Abrahamson's books.
I had read one of his books even before I was caught. His book, The Murdering Mind. I read that from the library. And then they told me right away that, watch out, because this man is crooked. The DA has already paid him off. He's going to find you sane no matter what you say. So don't talk to him. You know, just tell him what you told us or told the other doctors about the demons and things like this.
Your attorneys told you that?
Right. They coached me, you know, watch out for this guy. He's sneaky and everything else. This is why I had a very negative attitude towards him.
So as the sessions began, David reacted to Abrahamson with paranoia and hostility, the opposition installed by the DA to tear down his elaborate story, which now, quite inconveniently, he could not remember.
His initial reaction to Dr. Abrahamson was one of hostility. He knew that he was a psychiatrist there to work for the prosecution, to strip away the elaborate story he had told, which would have given him, arguably, a successful insanity, not guilty verdict had he gone to trial on these charges. But I got the impression that Dr. Abrahamson was a very good listener and very careful with his questioning, was a very good judge of character, saw through the illusion of the demon story.
Still, David gave it the old college try. I mean, he had built all this bullshit up to try to convince himself that it was good and right to do what he had done, and so if that got taken away from him, what would he be left with?
I fought him to the end, Abrahamson. I wanted to believe myself crazy because I couldn't face my own guilt.
I think it was a careful, surgically orchestrated leading of a man who was trying desperately to cling to a lie that he knew was a lie, to the point where he could have his psychiatric, as opposed to his earlier illusion of spiritual, come to Jesus moment. This is where I can begin to actually unwrap the mystery of who I am and why I did such horrible things.
David knew what was on the line.
My only safe ground was this demon story, because it's the only place I felt safe that if I got off this, then I would be exposed. I wasn't doing this consciously then. I realize that now, but unconsciously, I tried to pull back and steer it, you know. But he was too smart for that. He knew, you see. When the other three doctors had says, tell us, you know, encourage us, you know, they encouraged me, to continue with this demon thing. And then this is how it caught on so much and went to unbelievable heights.
It wasn't just a prison sentence that hung in the balance. It was David's guilt that hung in the balance as well. If he had the demon story to hide behind, he could remain in the shadows, suspended in an eternal state of non-confrontation, which is where he, of course, had always been the most comfortable.
This way I don't have to worry about a guilty conscience if it really was Sam Cardinal, his hench, satanic henchman or something, you see. But Dr. Abrahamson knew it. He never told me because he couldn't, you know, confront me with that stuff. He just wanted to save that for the court trial, you see. He was working for the prosecution. So everything I was saying, he was only recording. But on his own, he was comparing what I said, you know, to what the other doctors had said, you know, because they had the tape recorders going and they had all they transcribed everything I said on tape in the private interviews of the doctors. And he saw all the discrepancies, you see. Now, he didn't confront me with them, but he gave them to the district attorney. If there was a trial, then, you know, the doctor testify something, or I'd say something, and he'll say, but didn't you tell Dr. Abrahams this, that, you know what I mean? So he never confronted me, but I knew that he was right.
And so, silently and methodically, with a steady and expert hand, Dr. Abrahamson prepared a document to present to the judge at what would be David's second and final competency hearing, in order to determine if he would indeed stand trial and be sent to prison, or if he would be immediately reprimanded into custody by the psychiatric hospital, where he would escape public examination. But it wouldn't be only Abrahamson who would present findings. Schwartz and Weidenbacher were going to present as well. It would be the battle of the psychiatrists, except for it wouldn't, due to the fact that Schwartz and Weidenbacher had seemed to change their minds. Act 3, the second competency trial.
8 months later, when they had a second competency hearing, you know, the doctors then had changed their opinions. They still said that I was mentally deranged, but now suddenly I am competent. Yes, he could understand the charges, you understand? Mm-hmm. The first, Dr. Weidenbacher said that I was really far gone. But then he changed it and says, yes, he can understand everything. He sure he can help his lawyers. If he wants to help, he can help. You know, it's a defense. There's no problems there. And Dr. Schwartz, at first he said I was incompetent. Then he said I was incompetent. But on the stand, my defense attorney got him to swing back to unsure. So he said, I don't know. I just don't know. The judge said, well, Dr. Schwartz, is he competent or not? Dr. Schwartz raised his hands just like this. He said, I don't know. I just don't know. I guess they began to realize this after a while, but it was too late, you know, because they had already publicized their opinions. Their opinions were already publicized. Abrahamson was the only one that was unwavering.
Also, Dr. Abrahamson was the one David personally agreed with. Of course, he's not insane. He's a criminal mastermind who eluded police for over a year. But still, the stance regarding David's incompetency had, ironically, lost all competency in the eyes of all who saw it, namely the judge, once opinions had started to change.
The psychiatrists who had got behind the demon insanity defense were pretty much laughed out of court after that. Because it was like suddenly this veil had dropped, and just like the Wizard of Oz, you know, the curtain had been pulled back by this little puppy dog from Norway, this little doctor with maybe a funny accent. Pay no attention to that fool behind the curtain, you know. And here they were.
Abrahamson had been the entire time doggedly clear in his determination. David Berkowitz was competent to stand trial.
He found him competent to stand trial, able to understand what he had done and know the gravity and know that he had intentionally engaged in wrongful and harmful acts against innocent human beings. I think it's entirely spot on. It's accurate.
And so, now with two votes yes and one vote not sure, David was found competent to stand trial before a jury of his peers.
After the hearing was over, he found me competent, means I would have to stand trial. In other words, he was saying that I was guilty of the crimes.
And since he was still clinging to the demon story at the time, this was something David took quite personally. It brought about a much-needed breaking point in him, the first of what would turn out to be many. And so, David went back to his cell and requested to see the only person at that time who he could even vaguely identify as an ally.
I went back to my cell and I asked to see Dr. Schwartz. He took me inside his office and I started to talk, and I just broke down and cried very, very hard. I told him, Doctor, they don't believe me. They don't believe about Sam Carr and the demons. You know, and then the doctor says, yes, I know. That's because you're a very, very sick man. And he just happens to be narrow-minded. You know, he says, well, Dr. Schwartz says, well, yes, they don't believe you, but I do. I know about these demons, David. But I just started to cry. But you didn't understand what I was saying. So he took that as a sign that, yes, see, just look how sincerely this man is crying. Surely he is deranged, or... because he believes this story. See how much he believes the story? No, he misunderstood. I didn't cry because of that. I cried because Starkey, the judge, didn't believe the story.
Or maybe he cried because he knew the finding meant that he was going to have to confront all of this after all. And as I've said many times throughout this podcast, confrontation was decidedly not his bag.
And in my whole world, that's what I caved in because... now I had no alibi anymore, you know. There was no excuse for what I did, and then the reality that they're not accepting, you know, him and the judge and the public are not accepting the demon story.
No more Sam Carr, no more demons, no more Harvey angrily barking out murderous orders. David Berkowitz was now stranded on a deserted island alone. Just him and his completely unglamorous problems. But Dr. Abrahamson hadn't only offered an opinion as to competency, he had also made a diagnosis.
He went to some sort of character disorder?
Yeah. What do you say, hysterical or?
Compulsive, not insane.
Right.
Hysteria. Defined as emotionally charged behavior that seems excessive and out of control. I should say so.
He diagnosed Berkowitz is suffering from hysteria, which is not a pathological disorder per se, unless it's really extreme, but more an extreme form of neurosis, which many people have and are successfully treated for.
Jack asked David what he thought of Abrahamson's diagnosis.
How do you interpret the meaning of the word hysterical?
Well, that, from what I understand, it's like it's like something in your mind, you know. Something psychosomatic. If you think of yourself as unable to, you know, you convince yourself that you can't walk or something, and you're crippled, but it's only in your mind, you see. That's something that's a hysterical illness or something.
How did that relate to your condition?
Well, you psych yourself into believing something, you know.
In your case, you're psyching yourself into believing that you had to kill him?
Yeah, we know different. It's like almost self-brainwashing or something, you know, to convince yourself of your cause. When doubts creep in, you have to fight off the doubts, you know. When you begin to see things as being wrong, and you don't want them to be, you see, then you have to create something, an excuse or something.
Which was your hysterical reaction?
Yeah.
I think the diagnosis was a little more Freudian than I understand. It was a little heavier emphasis than was necessary on the psychosexual elements of the crime. But mainly, above and beyond that, was getting at, in a very clinical way, very real sexual repressions that Berkowitz had carried with him since childhood and fueled this confusion and anger that had caused him to engage in antisocial and malicious activities from as far back as he could remember.
And while it does seem to follow along with the story as I understand it, it also has the unfortunate added quality of working for David, leaving him sane, in control, the puppet master, pulling the strings and dictating events just as he always preferred to be. Not that he saw it that way at the time. At the time, I think he felt a little naked, having the Son of Sam mythology so unceremoniously taken from him.
And then I was stuck, because that left just me. Without that story, you know, there I was, exposed, just me. It's like a, you know, it's like a rock, right? The rock's been there for a long time in the moist soil, and underneath the rock is all the worms. You know, you ever lift up a rock or a piece of wood, and you see all these animals, little insects, and scurrying to go beneath the surface. Well, that was the way it was with me. Here I was, hiding behind this so-called demon story, you know, and burrowing underneath it. And every time somebody looked at me, that's all they can see was that thing. But once they took that away, there was nothing left, right? It was just me. I was underneath it, you know, and that's the way it was.
And in addition to all of David's personal concerns, there was now going to be a trial. Act 4, The Verdict.
So that judge, by being firm, said, well, I don't want to hear that stuff. That's not ridiculous, you know. And said, declared me competent for trial. You know, he rendered a decision right there. And so then I realized that, you know, he's not going to believe it. And I realized what it was nothing, you know. Shortly afterwards, I wound up pleading guilty altogether, even though my defense attorneys continued to hype the thing up and all that.
The judge ruled him competent to stand trial, but it was soon after that that he said, yes, I'm guilty, and I'm not going to subject myself or the public to a trial. At that point, he was really angry with the media for, he felt, exploiting his crimes and the victims, particularly for whom he had allegedly began to feel some way too late empathy. As much as anything, it was to deny the New York City jackals of the press the opportunity to further exploit the deaths of these innocent human beings and his own life. I think once David Berkowitz began to understand the implications of being found guilty by reason of insanity, perceived it as an attack on his morality and dignity. Of course I'm a sane person. Of course I'm a capable person. I organized and carried out murders. I'm an Army veteran. I was an independent, proud American who served my country. And once he began to realize that, he said, yeah, I want to be insane, but just morally insane.
And so, David Berkowitz pled guilty to all of the charges levied against him, which in the end meant there wasn't going to be a trial anyway. Another good thing, since, due to the fact that Detective Eddie Zygo, after seeing a shotgun in the backseat of Berkowitz's car on the day of his arrest, had broke in without a warrant, which meant that the guns and the letters were inadmissible. Which in turn meant that if Berkowitz had not pled guilty, then there was a fair chance he would have gotten off anyway.
I couldn't hold out. I couldn't convince myself. And the reasons I pled guilty, I never took this to trial, you see. I pled guilty is one, because I knew I was guilty. And number two, I was beginning to get the story messed up. And I think my defense attorneys even knew that too. So they didn't try to discourage me from pleading guilty, you see.
Cracks were now beginning to show in the Son of Sam mythology to the point that even David's defense attorneys didn't think he could convincingly tell it anymore. Owing to the fact that David had gone a little overboard with some of the details in the initial telling, and now as a result, couldn't remember them all. David puts it this way.
I realized then that I was getting caught up in my own lies, you know, my own fairy tales and exaggerations.
And so David's guilty plea was accepted by the court, and he was sentenced on June 12, 1978. At his sentencing, he shouted, quote, "Stacy is a whore, Stacy is a whore," end quote. A reference to his final shooting victim, Stacy Moskowitz, a final, personal, and very public insult to her entire family.
His sentence was 6 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole, or if he ever was eligible for parole under the law, he would have had to have lived for more than 3 centuries, to the age of about 357 years old. So he's effectively incarcerated for the rest of his life.
New York State only invokes the death penalty when a police officer is killed, so this was the maximum penalty that could be reasonably passed down. 6 consecutive sentences of 25 to life. And there's a big difference between consecutive and concurrent sentences. Jack explains.
Concurrent sentences would be 25 to life, regardless how many people you killed. They would all be served in that one 25-year period. Consecutive means first you're going to go to prison for murdering your first victim, another 25 for your second victim, right on through number 6, with additional charges for an overdue parking ticket and attempted murder of the people that you shot but did not kill. He was effectively sentenced to life in prison without the opportunity even to ever apply for parole. He went quietly off to a psychiatric facility initially for pre-examination and then was assigned to Attica Prison, where he, to my astonishment, wrote me a letter and asked to meet.
Act 5. Hello, is this thing on? Once David was sent up to Attica, the prison made nationally infamous for a full-scale riot back in 1971, which resulted in the deaths of 43 guards and inmates alike, David set about adjusting to his new life, free from the strains of juggling finances, paying rent, meeting women, or trying to feed himself. But on the other hand, he was the guy who had just told the world that a barking dog had instructed him to kill, which was bound to catch him some flack from more than a few of the other inmates.
Has anybody here in prison given you any kind of grief about the demon thing?
When I first got here, yeah. They started with the dogs, you know. Kill, Davey, kill. They used to goof like that. You know, Sam is coming. I started to go woof, woof with the dogs.
Did that make you angry when they were doing that?
It was annoying. I wasn't really angry, you know, because I was used to it. It was like I was in the circus for so long, you know, being dragged in front of the courts, jam-packed with people in these huge courtrooms, and
being dragged through the streets, you know, in the armored van, and all the people looking and crowding around the front of the building, booing and hissing and all this.
After failing so miserably at the pressures of life on the outside, the pressures of life on the inside were somehow no problem.
He knew he would be targeted. He knew he would be harassed by guards and inmates. He believed that he would be killed. And he did, like most of these guys, though, soon settle in and become accepted by both the guards because he was a model prisoner in terms of behavior. A lot of bad people, borderline psychotic people that give guards hell in prisons. And he wasn't one of those guys. Plus, he had military training like a lot of the guards. He had a lot in common with them. And as a criminal and being notorious, there were a lot of guys in there who had done things almost as bad as he had done. Most guys, after a while, you're just one of us. We get along, and as long as you don't disrespect me, we're going to get along peacefully.
David Berkowitz was fitting in, despite initially having some reservations about going to prison for the rest of his life. Quote, just before I pled guilty, I was very apprehensive. I knew that I would be going to prison and that it would be for a long time. I didn't know what it would be like, and I was being my usual pessimistic self. So to me, it seemed that only terrible horrors awaited me in prison. As it turned out, Attica prison isn't so bad, end quote. Wasn't so bad for a while, until one day he picked up the paper.
And then one day I pick up the newspaper and I read a small article in your paper, multi-million-dollar book deal, Berkowitz's attorneys, former attorneys, Jule Takenstern, defense attorney, signed over the book rights, you know, at a $10 million deal to the McGraw-Hill Book Company. And I said, and that, you know, was on the tip of my tongue all the time to tell the truth to society, you know, so they know once and for all that this demon thing was nonsense. But reading that article motivated me once and for all to say, all right, that's it. I can't take it anymore. We're not going to sit. Because I know what they were going to do. It was the whole buildup of this demon thing. Because they're defense attorneys. They now they got to defend their own position, you know. And the doctors were right with them.
David's defense attorneys had beat David to the punch. They were telling the story themselves, which meant that they had their hand on the rudder. And David did not like that one bit. That, not the antagonism of the other prisoners, had made him angry.
Even though he himself couldn't articulate any reason for why he had done what he had done, he needed to be the one who explained it, and it needed to be explained in his own way, step by step, in a manner that would benefit him and point a finger at who he had begun to view as the real villain, the media that was exaggerating and exploiting both his life and the lives of the victims in order to generate readership, viewership, and advertising sales and money.
And so he did something about it. He stuck to his now old standby and wrote them a letter.
And so I just sort of Jule Tack a letter saying, don't be my attorney anymore. You're fired. It wasn't very official. Just a type letter. You're fired. Goodbye. That's what I said, basically. And that was it. Haven't dealt with him since.
But that wasn't enough. He still needed a way to get his own version of events out to the public. He needed a way to swing the spotlight back onto himself. And so, David Berkowitz called a press conference.
He summoned the media to a press conference, which was organized. And, of course, the gaggle of cameras and notebooks showed up and simply wanted to say once and for all that the Son of Sam story was a hoax, that there were no demons. And from this point on, he was going to devote his life to doing what he could to support crime victims. I don't recall reading a lot of the stories at that time, but he was generally derided by the press for suddenly becoming the voice of what should be media ethics and reporting on criminal activities. He was tired of seeing the whole saga exploited by any form of media at that time. And very quickly, Crime Victims Compensation Board, as they worked on developing the Son of Sam law, he viewed the law which would prevent him and other criminals from profiting from their crimes, as maybe even a reason that he had unwittingly committed these crimes. A law named after a character of his creation, the Son of Sam. And it also would deny or control the media profits that were generated by further exploitation of unauthorized versions of the story. At last, he's the good guy. He has something to hang his imagined dignity upon.
Not surprisingly, nobody was having it. The world just wasn't ready for David Berkowitz, victim's advocate.
Hold a press conference. You remember that press conference. It says, look, I got to tell you the truth. You know, they didn't, they covered it, you know, they didn't see any significance of what I was saying, but told them the truth. It says, it's just stuff, you know, I was reaching a point of self-awareness, you understand? It's beginning to realize that this was what was happening, you know, what was happening, why I made up the Nima story, you know, to cover my guilt. And they didn't, you know, they did a little cover a little bit, but never got much further.
David Berkowitz was now firmly situated in his own personal and limitless silence. He had no way of communicating with the outside world, no way to pull the strings, no way to let everyone know, by force if necessary, who he was and what he was thinking whenever the mood struck him. That is, unless, of course, he could find someone who could do it for him, which one day he did, or rather, he thought he did. He figured he had a pretty good chance, anyway.
And then I wrote a letter to Dr. Abrahamson one day and says, Doctor, I'd love to talk to you, you know, if it would be possible. I wrote him a one-page typewritten letter. And I sent it to his address. A month later, the thing came back, no such address. Oh, Jesus. So I had somebody in New York City look up his name and call around and find out if he was a doctor to handle my case. So when I came back, I put the letter in another envelope and sent it out. Meantime, I already lost a month and a half. Finally, about March of 1978 or late February, the letter got through to Abrahamson and said he'd be willing to come up to talk to me, you know. And he did. And then start our relationship.
But it wouldn't turn out exactly the way David intended it. Next time on Killer Tape, David Berkowitz pours his heart out to Dr. Abrahamson, resulting in his finally confronting why he had murdered so many helpless young people.
I poured out my heart to the guy, told him how guilty I was, and he knew about this all the time. He says, I knew about it. The important thing is that you finally realized it. You see, I could have told you this long ago, but you didn't want to hear it. And he realized, too, that I couldn't face it then. You know, I couldn't accept my own guilt.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D., and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.